I love going out on the road. I love performing. This is what I was born to do. And even more than that, I know it's a calling.
And the morning we went in to deliver the twins is when they discovered that our son Aiden's heartbeat had stopped.
In that doubt, sometimes those thoughts aren't my own thoughts. Those are placed, you know, there to stop you from achieving what you can achieve.
Hello and welcome to Latter-day Profiles. I'm Brian Howard here on the LDS Motion Picture Studio set in Provo, Utah. And joining me today is Keith Erickson. Keith, welcome. So good to have you.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Currently, at the time we're taping this, Keith is the director of the Church History Library. As we're talking, your job function is changing a little bit, but we can talk about that as well. An author, a book that's come out recently, Real versus Rumor, and it's a good one. It's, I need to have something riveting while I'm mowing the lawn, so I've been listening to it, and it's really enlightening. Although I have to say, some of the myths that were busted, a little disappointing, but that's a really cool book.
I hope your lawn survives.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's good stuff. Let's talk a little bit about your background. Where did you grow up at, and how did you get, let's talk about your career path, because, you know, how did history get in there at some point?
Sure. I grew up in Maryland, and then I went to BYU, and history came later. It actually came in my graduate studies.
Yeah.
I did an undergraduate degree in sociology and really liked it, but then a bunch of factors came together, and I did a master's degree in history, and that's where I decided that that's what I really enjoyed. So then that led to a PhD and down the road.
Yeah, what pulled you into that? You know, sociology and history, were there some turning point that you think this is really a thing I want to do?
You know, it really was a moment with a faculty member. I was taking a church history class, and the faculty member called me up after class and said, "Hey, I'm looking for a research assistant, and I think you make good comments in class. I think you'd be good." And I said, "I have no idea how to do historical research or anything." And he said, "Don't worry, I'll teach you." So we literally met the first day of the job was in the library, and we just started reading and researching, and we moved into archival materials and primary sources. So I literally came in through the archive, not through the classroom. And that's where I got excited about documents and sources and evidence, because that was the way that history became interesting to me.
Hmm. So it pays to speak up in class occasionally.
I guess
sometimes
so.
It really does
that
pay.
One worked out.
How did you choose Indiana for your PhD? How did that come about?
Well, as I got into the study of history, I came to know that I liked something that we call in the profession public history. Hmm. And so it's less about studying a specific subject. You know, there will be people who will study George Washington for their entire career and become an expert. Public history is more about the reception of history and how audiences engage with history at historic sites, at museums, in school classrooms. And so as I looked around the landscape, there were a couple of faculty members at Indiana University who had done work in this area that I really admired. And then there was one other faculty member at the University of Wisconsin, but they didn't have a graduate program, so I got excited about Indiana. And then midway through, that professor from Wisconsin came to Indiana, so I had kind of my whole dream team there to help me think about issues. So my dissertation there in Indiana was about Abraham Lincoln, but it was about 20th century commemoration. So I got into kind of local interest in Lincoln and just the way that people looked to him and commemorated him.
So. Interesting. Well, yeah, Lincoln's always got an interesting topic. Anything particular about that drew you to Lincoln to pick that as your topic?
Well, you know, I was casting around for topics, and it literally hit me one day when I was in the archives reading room, and I thought, I'm totally surrounded by Lincoln. Everything here is Lincoln. Indiana claimed him, Illinois claimed him, Kentucky claimed him, he was born. There was kind of some rivalry and competition, and I thought, this is everything I want. The air was just infused with Lincoln, and so that became that was the fun thing to do.
It's good to be popular. Everybody claims you, so
that's
a great thing. Now, how did you end up at down at the University of Texas, El Paso, UTEP?
Well, you know the way the job market works. You apply everywhere, and that was the one that was the best offer. And so my appointment at UTEP involved helping history teachers. So they would major in secondary ed, but then we had a program in the history department that would help them learn to think and teach like a historian. And so it was a really great place to be. And then, you know, I worked up through the ranks there, got tenure, and then also along the way, I became an assistant to the university president. UTEP was celebrating its 100th anniversary, and so she invited me to help organize and manage the centennial celebration for the university. So I got to do public history and, you know, kind of create the events and the experiences and help people connect with the past of the school.
Well, it sounds like you had a really great experiences there. You were, you know, honored for the things that you did. So good place for you. At 7, we talked earlier, you thought maybe Texas is going to be our lifetime home, right?
Yeah, we loved it there. We loved the people, we loved the culture, we loved the weather, and it was just a great, wonderful experience. So yeah, we thought we'd stay.
But then, an opportunity came, I guess. How did you end up here in Utah at the Church History Library?
You know, that's a story that I probably don't know all the details for. I've learned some pieces. I learned there was kind of a strategic planning session where they identified people out and about. My first encounter was I was at a history conference somewhere, and someone came up from the church and said, "Hey, would you ever think about working for the church?" And I had never thought of that before. I didn't really do church history I said, "Well, is this a real job or just a hypothetical question?" And they said, "Oh, no, it's only hypothetical." And so I just laughed. I said, "Well, I have real children who eat real food and I need a real job." Every couple of years, somebody would make contact and say, "Would you ever think about it?" And I'd give my same stock answer. So several years in, they called and said, "You know, you always tell us if we have a job, you'd consider it." "Well, we have one." I said, "Okay, you caught me. I guess I have to consider it now." And so it was, it was to serve as the director of the library. And I guess the shortest way to say it is, we prayed about it, and it all kind of made sense, and the pieces came together. And so 7 years later, here we are.
Traded in the warmth for the snow, so it's all good.
I did ask if I could do it remotely from El Paso, and they said, "No, probably not."
Not going to happen. Well, that's good. It's got to make you feel good that you're, being considered and talked about in a good way, that your skills have been noticed. Kind of good for your self-esteem, I guess.
I guess so.
So tell me about, when you arrived, what were you expecting? And did it live up to, whatever those expectations were to come and work for the Church History Library?
Yeah, boy, the expectation question is an interesting one, because I knew a little bit of what to expect, but I also knew that I had no clue of what to expect. And so, there is a tremendous team there of archivists and librarians and records managers, technologists who do all kinds of miracles in gathering the church's records and preserving them and making them available. So, I started by learning a lot and listening, and we had a strong leadership team, and so we just kind of, as challenges came up, we just set to them. But the last 15 years have really been marked by tremendous outreach from the library. We have a catalog that's online. We've begun digitizing records during normal times that don't involve a pandemic or shutting down things. We were scanning 2.5 million images per year and putting them into the catalog. Just a lot of opportunities to figure out how to share the church's records.
Church history is so important, to the church wanting to track and keep track of all those things. I have no idea how much is in there. Is that overwhelming, what's actually in the library? Do you have a sense? I mean, it'd be nice to touch everything, but there's just so much.
Well, here's a confession. We don't know how much is in there. And part of that is the way that it's managed. Records will come in large sets, and we'll catalog them, the big ones. It might be 110 boxes of minutes of the presiding bishopric meeting. And so we know that we have 110 boxes, but at the level of how many pages and what's on them, there's not a human way to do that. And that would be one collection, you know. So the library has just under a quarter of a million collections. We can count, the online catalog has more than 20 million assets, and that includes documents and photos, but also video. And so there's 20 million things that you could see online right now, and that would take up a lifetime to just see that. We estimate, based on kind of a loose gauge of titles, that we've put about 5% online. Wow. So there's a lot to go. Yeah, the church is 200 years old, and from the very beginning, the day that it was organized, the revelation that's now in section 21 says, commands Joseph to keep a record, and so people, we have lots of records that have been kept.
Is there an overarching goal? You know, you talked about, you know, helping people understand, publicizing, that kind of thing. Is there an overarching goal for, you know, church history?
Yeah, you know, church history as a department is bigger than just the library. The library, there's a sister institution, the museum. The department also manages the historic sites and a publishing program, which includes the Joseph Smith papers and saints and those kind of products. And so across all of those different activities, we generally want to gather and preserve records, but then we want to use them. We want to help people remember what God has done. Help them see the hand of God in history and in their own experience. There are also ways that church history, you know, helps to defend the church, defend the truth. And sometimes it's, you know, at a kind of big kind of doctrinal level, you know, like this is a revelation and we have a record of it and it's true. But also it happens at more mundane levels, like when there are questions about who owns what piece of property, and we have the property deeds and titles or in the collection. And so there are many, many ways that the records get used each day to defend the church, to witness for the truth, and to help people, ultimately to learn more about God.
Yeah. And, you know, in the casual conversation, and so he says, meet you. Hey, nice to meet you, Keith. And he says, oh, I'm director of the Church History Library. Oh, what's the first question you get? What's the most common question you get from people to find out what you do?
The most common question is if we have the Sword of Laban or not. Hands down. That one gets asked all the time. So
don't ask, don't tell.
Well, you know, the simple answer is no. And a little bit more involved answer is, you know, we've never had it. You know, you think about the gold plates. Moroni gave them to Joseph. He took them back, kind of back and forth. The Sword of Laban was only ever shown. The three witnesses saw it. Joseph saw it. It was in the stone box with the plates. But to use library term, it was never checked out to Joseph. It was never handed over to a mortal. And so it was never able to be passed down. So.
Well, let's talk about the book that you've written. I think, again, really interesting. And you know, within the church, there are lots of stories. And as I was reading through, it's like, oh, I know that story. Oh, I've heard that story. What was the impetus for writing the book? How did that come about?
Well, in many ways, it was kind of a connection of my previous life at the university, doing a lot of work with history teaching and learning and helping people to understand how to do historical thinking. And then connecting with the work at the Church History Library, where Latter-day Saints will either call or email or come right into the building and say, you know, such and such I believe is true. And we say, well, no, probably not. And so it just, you know, kind of slowly became a realization, these kind of skills in thinking and analysis and evaluating historical information would be really helpful in a church where we're engaged with history all of the time, in our curriculum, in our hymns, in our scripture study. We're reading historical texts. And so that kind of became the impetus.
Mm. Well, let's go through an example. One that you mentioned is like Elvis in the Book of Mormon. And the funny thing is, my wife has a story, a friend who's from, you know, like the Graceland area, wanted to go see that. And this was years before you published that.
Right.
Well, probably not. But you have the sniff test and other things. What are those skills to figure out that this probably didn't really happen the way we think it did?
Yeah, well, in that particular case, it was... I had an assignment to talk about that book in a media interview, and I'd never looked at it. And so I just thought, well, I better do my homework so I can say something on screen. And the first time that I looked at the book and then kind of the story around it, it just didn't add up. You know, so you mentioned the sniff test. I didn't know much about Elvis Presley. I didn't know much about the book, but the pieces didn't fit together. And in particular, this case, there were multiple stories of the book's provenance or where it came from. And they conflicted. One version was that Elvis's father didn't want anybody to know that he was reading the book. And so somebody luckily rescued it. The other version was Elvis's father personally asked it to be delivered to the Osmond family because he knew they would appreciate it. Well, those two stories can't both be accurate at the same time. And so it's things like that that then, that was the start. That was the sniff test that said, something's not right. And then that launches the full process of the investigation and analysis. And in that case, ultimately, we consulted with 5 independent handwriting experts who confirmed our suspicion that the handwriting wasn't Elvis's. So
no Elvis, no Book of Mormon. So the stored Book of Mormon was a nice story, but not real.
Well, and in that particular case, now there are other stories, other people who gave Elvis a copy of the Book of Mormon, and missionaries do that all the time now. They'll bump into someone famous somewhere and hand them a Book of Mormon. You know, I suspect what happens in most cases is celebrities just pass it off to whoever's closest to them and say, thank you, whatever.
Sure.
This particular book, because it, you know, claimed to have handwriting, notes, places where Elvis was engaging with the text and expressing belief, you know, that's what made this particular copy, I think, so appealing to people, the idea that Elvis had read and engaged with the text. But ultimately, that also gave us more evidence. We could look at all of that handwriting, and it was just not even close.
Mm. So ones like that are obviously somebody who's, you know, whatever, forging, messing around, whatever you want to call it, and
sure,
it wasn't true. Some others, as I was reading through the book, it's like the crickets and the seagulls. So we all know that story,
right?
But it's not quite exactly what it's become in our folklore. So, you know, for the ones like that, then how do you kind of figure those out? Because you obviously spelled out pretty plain that, oh, it's not quite what we're always talking about when we talk about the crickets and the seagulls and saving the crops.
Well, with this kind of story, I like to encourage a thinking habit that uses a line that that they use in many courtrooms around the world. You want the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And those three categories help kind of frame the way we look at this story. So, yes, there are true things in the story, the way we tell it, that the pioneers were struggling and crickets came and were eating the crops and then seagulls came and ate crickets. But then we ask about the whole truth, and that alerts us to the fact that over time, parts of the story get forgotten. They get left out and stories become more focused. But there are other parts of that story that get left out, such as there was a tremendous drought that same year. There was also late frosts. And so in May of 1848, their crops were freezing at night, and the crickets, or they were actually katydids, were eating them during the day. And so in the journals of the time period, there's much more concern about the frost and the drought than about the insects. And so that's something that got omitted when we look at that. The other thing that gets omitted is the seagulls come in their kind of normal migratory pattern, and then they leave a few weeks later, and they're still crickets for 2 more months. But when we condense it down, we imagine the birds swoop in, eat every cricket, and there's no more challenge ever again. And so that's one of the way that happens. Then the last part of that, you know, nothing but the truth, this happens over time, and sometimes it's well-meaning, but people add to stories, they embellish them. And so over time, there gets the sense that this never happened before, which in fact, it was a seasonal pattern. Bugs come, birds come, and that's kind of how nature works. And there were other times, but people would forget about those and emphasize the one. And so all of those processes are at play. We're forgetting things, we're adding things. And so the goal is to kind of remember the things we've forgotten, strip away the things that have been added, and then kind of get a sense of what happened.
So why is it important? You know, we all love these stories, you know, they're faith promoting, but like you said, it's nice to know actually reality, what happened, if we're actually there versus what's been morphed into years and years. Why is it important to start thinking that way or to see things slightly differently in your opinion?
Well, you know, I think at the heart, we are a people who believe in truth. Yeah. We seek truth. And so I think we need to seek that everywhere in all of the things that we do. And not just in church history, we need to seek it in politics. We need to seek it in medical information. You know, our current society is swarming in misinformation and disinformation. And so these skills, if we are a people who seek truth, and the Doctrine and Covenants sets a pretty high bar. It says that truth is a knowledge of things as they really were, as they really are, and as they will be to come. And so I know less about things that will be to come, but we need to work really hard at things as they really are and as they really were. And that's the place where we can. And I think the drawback, if we don't do that, you know, we're just setting ourselves up for trouble later. Yeah. When somebody encounters the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth in some other way, they say, well, how come I didn't learn this before? Yeah. And so I think it becomes important to seek truth.
Yeah, I agree. So what's your advice? So we're sitting in Sunday school and one of those stories comes up. You don't want to be
person.
Hey, that's a lie. Well, that's not quite true. So how do you handle that? What's your thought on that?
You know, this is a great question. And it's one that a few years ago, I was young men's president, and I would teach the young men this, because teenagers especially get excited to know that old people are wrong and that they want to correct them. And so we kind of worked out a strategy, which is, you know, less confrontational, less threatening, because you also don't want to do that. You know, that kind of contention is a problem. Sure. For the lesson, for the spirit. Sure. for your relationship as a fellow ward member or neighbor or whatever. And so what I would recommend is, number one, to know where you can get the accurate answers. And there are places in the Gospel Library app, on the church website, places where this kind of information is presented. And, you know, a simple way would just be to say, you know, in the flow of the class, you know, to say something like, you know, there's new information about that story, or we have a more complete understanding of that. And here's a place where you can read about it. And, you know, and you can say it doesn't. And most of the time, it doesn't necessarily detract from the specific message they're trying to share that day. People who tell the story about the crickets want to emphasize that God loves us and watches over us. That's true, independent of the specific facts. And so you can say, you know, I believe with all my heart that God watches over us. I also know there's a little more information about this, and here's a place where people can learn more about it. And I think an approach like that will be helpful, because ultimately people have to go and study for themselves.
Right.
And so enabling them to do that, I think, helps.
So be open mind, thinking about things. Don't be a cynic, but always ask the questions to make sure you're getting the right story.
Yeah.
I think that is, we often take everything at face value because we want to, and we've heard the stories. And if we've heard them 100 times, we kind of assume that they're accurate.
You know, and here's another strategy. This often happens. You're sitting in Sunday school and you remember a story or a thing,
yeah,
but you don't remember who said it or where it is. What people do is they raise their hand and they think, this must be inspiration, so I'm going to tell you this thing. I would counsel something else. If it comes to you with some of the information but not all, one of the promises of the Holy Ghost will bring all things to your remembrance. So if it's not all coming there, there's a reason, and that's probably a stupor of thought. We have a phrase for that you don't know all of the detail. But what I found in my own experience, because that happens to me sitting in class, I'll go home, I'll study it out, I'll research it, I'll find out, oh, I misremembered this, I got that. But once I do that study and get all the facts straight in my head, I find that the next week and the week after that, there are opportunities in church, with my family, whatever, to share the accurate thing. And what I've learned is that prompting in class isn't for me to just spew what randomly popped in my mind. It's an invitation for me to study and figure it out and then be ready to treasure it up in my mind, and then be ready to share it when I've got all the facts right.
Keith, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. The book, Real Versus Rumor, and you can check that out and enjoy also the Church History Library. That's a great resource for us. I appreciate you taking the time, Keith. Thank you so much.
Hey, my pleasure.